Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain, and once more I've been joined at my sexy little lout by Pete Hart.
Hello, Gary.
What are we doing today, Pete?
Well, we're doing the Air War over the Somme super series, and this one's called Up in the Skies, 1st of July, 1916.
Oh, good of you to chuck the year in then.
Yeah, and we've led up to this. We've done the background and all the air fighting that preceded it. Now we're on the actual day itself. And can you picture it, Gary? Picture it for me. What's it like? What sort of a day is it?
Well, it was a Saturday, the 1st of July brought the dawning of a perfect summer's day. A gentle, soothing southwesterly breeze, a clear sky, and a temperature that climbed to a balmy 72 degrees Fahrenheit.
I had no idea. How did you know what I was going to say?
Now, 07:30, the officers' whistles blew all along the line, and the brave men of Kitchener's army climbed out of their trenches and began their stumble to destiny across no man's
land. Purple prose, Gary. Purple prose.
So, their confidence, for the most part, was high, and many thought it would be literally and figuratively a walkover.
Yeah, they're wrong, and it's not their fault. It's the bombardment. It seems earth-shattering, doesn't it? But it's flattering to deceive, really. They fired a lot of shells, but the
how many?
Seven. Seven lots.
It was millions, wasn't it?
I don't think it was millions.
It was millions and millions and millions.
It was lots. I think I always
one,
was,
two, three, lots.
I think we'll go for that. But it was on a front of about 20 miles. And the actual, this is a point that you've made very well, very cogently, I think. The actual number of shells falling per yard of German trench is less than they achieved at Neuve-Chapelle back in March 1915. And that means that because there isn't now just one line or one and a half lines like at Neuve-Chapelle, there's now three trench systems each, you know, with the front two have got three lines each. Then there's redoubts. There's not enough shells. And later on in the war, they would fire 3.5 million in a day sort of thing, shells.
So basically what you're saying is the diluted shells, yeah. If you could dilute a shell.
Well, the impact of it is...
It needed a far greater concentration to guarantee the outright destruction, not only of the front line, but the system.
Yeah. And Haig had extended the depth they were trying to get to, which makes it worse. It's not Haig's greatest move in many people's view. There are reasons why they do it. But let's not get into that now.
Well, furthermore, the integral strength of the numerous
integral
German strong points...
You've swallowed a dictionary today.
...had not been recognised. And I'm spelling recognised with a Z.
Oh, are you? You American.
Now, the Germans, they'd constructed deep concrete shelters and dugouts, especially in the villages that dotted the area.
Yeah, a lot of the cellars had been expanded, reinforced, chained together underground. Each village becomes like a fortress in its own right. And what you need to knock out one of these strong concrete strong points is you need pinpoint accuracy of multiple direct hits by heavy shells if they're going to destroy it or incapacitate the garrison. Now, the problem is... field artillery shell. So what we're talking there, we're talking the 4.5 inch, the 18 pounders. They're just rearranging the bricks. They're not actually going to destroy a concrete fortress. And there's another thing. What other point would you make about pinpoint accuracy? What do you need for pinpoint accuracy?
Well, you need highly trained individuals to operate the guns, and the gunners, for the most part, were new to their trade.
Yeah, they're relatively new. Yeah, that's absolutely spot on. So they're not really up to it. And then there's a problem with the shells. They're not manufactured to the highest tolerance because they've massively increased it.
But we're not saying actually that the barrage was wholly ineffective, are we? We're saying for many of the German frontline troops, they had actually been killed, wounded, or buried by direct hits on their trenches and dugouts.
Yeah. But many more had survived. In fact, the mass majority had survived. You can imagine it. They're physically, they're mentally, I think the term is battered or buggered, one of the two. You can imagine their ears ringing. It's like going to see those naughty lumps, your ears ringing, you're in pain, you're suffering. But you're cut off from your neighbours. You might even be a bit shell shocked. But for the most part, they're still alive. They're ready to do their duty. And there's another point about the barrage. One of the great British inventions of the war, which probably was invented by the French, of course, like most great British inventions. But what am I talking about now? Well, it wasn't in use yet.
Well, it wasn't fully developed. You're talking about the absence of a proper creeping barrage, yeah, aren't you? And what that meant was that the British guns, in effect, they lifted their fire from the German front line and began to pound the rear areas, just as the troops went over the top and across no man's land, precisely at the moment when they most needed the shells to be moving towards and across the German front line.
So, absolutely.
So they weren't sophisticated, if you like, in developing the creeping barrage at that time.
And the other point, I think this point definitely can be overemphasised, because there's as many tactical approaches on the front line as there is units in many ways. But many of the units, they weren't sophisticated tactics employed. They advanced in waves, pretty slowly, plodding, you might say, although that's partly the weight of equipment that they have to carry. There was a feeling that they couldn't do more sophisticated tactics, and that feeling was probably right in some ways. But the British, when they go over the top, what are the British always when they go over the top, for the most part?
Well, they're full of confidence and pluck.
British pluck would win the day, Gary.
It would. And this is Lieutenant Alfred Bundy of the 2nd Middlesex Regiment. And you're going to tell us what Alfred Bundy says.
Went over the top at 7:30 after what seemed an interminable period of terrible apprehension. Our artillery seemed to increase in density and the German guns opened up on no man's land. The din was deafening, the fumes choking, and visibility limited owing to the dust and clouds caused by exploding shells. It was a veritable inferno. I was momentarily expected to be blown to pieces. My platoon continued to advance in good order, without many casualties, until we had reached nearly halfway to the Boche front line. I saw no sign of life there. Unfortunately, it's a British...
He saw no sign of life there, did he?
Yeah, I'm just...
And then he finished.
He did finish. I was getting excited. One thing, you just noticed that. Of course he was... they were called... He was naturally worried. When we say they're confident they were going to win, they're still worried. Obviously you're worried before you go over the top. So I'm not saying that they were laughing and gay as they went over. The other point is the British failure to employ proper counter battery fire. And that's what you notice in that account, is that the British guns increase their rate of fire, but the German guns reply because they haven't been taken, as you would say, air.
Now, unfortunately, as the British barrage lifted from their front line, the Germans had time to emerge from their dugouts and began to pour rifle and machine gun fire into their slow-moving opponent. opponents. They were, in fact, easy targets.
They were. And this is Alfred Bundy, Lieutenant Alfred Bundy, 2nd Middlesex, says, "Suddenly an appalling rifle and machine gun fire opened against us and my men commenced to fall. I shouted, 'Down!' But most of those who were still not hit had already taken what cover they could find. I dropped in a shell hole and occasionally attempted to move to my right and left, but bullets were forming an impenetrable barrier and exposure of the head meant certain death. None of our men were visible, but in all directions came pitiful groans and cries of pain." And this is the point. But I want to make it clear, it's not just machine guns and rifles. It's this German artillery barrage. They're dreaded batteries of 5.9. They're sweeping across the British front line. They're sweeping across the no man's land. They haven't taken the batteries out. And in later battles, this is one of the big lessons, that you must take out the concealed German batteries.
Let's be fair here. This was despite the best efforts of the Royal Artillery.
Yeah.
Many of the concealed German batteries, they had survived. And those that had been identified had neither been properly destroyed in advance or, I think the word would be, suppressed by the gunners' programme of counter-battery fire during the crucial moments when British troops were in no man's land. In front of them, the shells had failed also to clear the wire. And in most places, it was almost untouched.
Yeah, great points, Gary, because And the thing, you mentioned suppression, but suppression is partly gas shells.
Yes, absolutely.
And that hasn't been invented by the British anyway. And that's not there. Mustard gas isn't there. Those weapons from 1918 are physically not there. And as for the wire, they haven't got the 106 instantaneous explosive fuses, which come in 17. You can't use a weapon before it's invented.
Now, so it was that above them, the contact patrols witnessed tragedy unparalleled in British military history before or since.
Yeah.
As Lieutenant Cecil Lewis flew his Marine parasol above La Boisselle, his eyes were glued to the ground. And this is what 2nd Lieutenant Cecil Lewis of 3rd Squadron Royal Flying Corps says. "I was on the first patrol on the northern part of the salient from Pozières down to Fricourt. They'd put down two enormous mines right on the front line, hoping to clear the whole of the front line with this enormous burst. This was what we were looking for. We had our watches synchronised. We were up at about 8,000 feet and really it was a fantastic sight because when the hurricane bombardment started, every gun we had, and there were thousands of them, had all been let loose at once. It was wild. You could hear the roar of the guns above the noise of the aircraft, like a rain on a pane. Extraordinary, this roll of thousands of guns at the same time. Then came the blast when we were looking at the La Boisselle salient. Suddenly, the whole earth heaved and up from the ground came great cone-shaped lifts of earth up to 3,000, 4,000 or 5,000 feet. A moment later, we struck the repercussion wave of the blast, which flung us right away backwards over on one side away from the blast."
That's a fantastic description, isn't it? Cecil Lewis, that's from the BBC Great War series that's taken. Great quotes. He's a great, great chap, Cecil Lewis. Now, what's he doing? What's his role? His role up there in that Marine parasol is to determine the exact progress of the troops on the ground. This is a contact patrol, and he needs to tell them why. Why do they need to know exactly how far the infantry have got, would you say?
Well, it's vital to inform the supporting artillery batteries, as it had been found through bitter experience that conventional means of communication frequently broke down when the troops launched themselves across no man's land.
Yeah. Because you might say, well, why can't they just telephone? Well, the German counter-bombardment, that's slathering across the British front lines and it cuts telephone links, it kills runners. And basically, they've just gone into the blue. Now, let's have another quote from brilliant old 2nd Lieutenant Cecil Lewis. This describes how well the contact patrol techniques work. So go through it for us. Cecil, I like calling you Cecil, Gary.
"We had all our contact patrol technique perfected and we went right down to 3,000 feet to see what was happening. We had a klaxon horn on the undercarriage of the Marine, a great big 12-volt klaxon, and I had a button which I used to press out a letter to tell the infantry what we wanted to know, that we wanted to know where they were. When they heard us hawking at them from above, they had little red Bengal flares. They carried them in their pockets. They would put a match to their flares. All along the line, wherever there was a chap, there would be a flare, and we would note these flares down on the map, and Bob's your uncle. It was one thing to practice this, but quite another thing for them to really do it when they were under fire, and particularly when things began to go a bit badly. Then they jolly well wouldn't light anything, and small blame to them, because it drew the fire of the enemy onto them at once. So we went down looking for flares, and we only got about 2 flares on the whole front. We were bitterly disappointed, because this, we hoped, was our part to help the infantry, and we weren't able to do it.
Contact patrols never really work in the whole war. I mean, it's difficult. They even have schemes where they took umbrella-like things. They have all sorts of mad schemes, but they often don't work. Now, let's sum up what happened. So the attack, it's launched by the French army over by the Somme River, and the British have sent in the...
What do you mean, the French army? The French were on the Somme.
Well, the French do better than us on the first day, and we did a podcast with that...
Oh, yeah.
..that chap. That you remember it now. You don't remember the details of it, though, do you? But we have the... Now, this is difficult. Let's see if you can say it. What corps, British corps, were attacking?
The 13th.
Yes.
The 15th.
Yes.
The 3rd.
Yeah.
The 10th.
Yeah.
The 8th. The 8th Corps of 4th Army. And they all attacked along from Montauban to Serre.
And then north of Serre, you've got the 7th Corps of 3rd Army making a diversionary attack on Gomicourt, which we did a podcast on. Funnily enough, I found that more interesting. That's my favourite. That attracts my interest, that whole diversionary attack.
Now, on this day of failure...
Oh, no.
..the French prospered. They succeeded making an advance of about a mile, almost uniformly, along the stretch of front attacked.
Yeah, and with the help of their artillery, and I want to make that clear, on their left, the 13th and 15th Corps attacks are also relatively successful, although there are a fair number of casualties. And they achieved their objectives. They pushed the line forwards from Montauban, facing Bernafay Wood, to Mamet. Although the Free Corps was still held, it's isolated, and that would fall the next day, the 2nd of July, I think you'll find that is, Gary.
Now, along the rest of the front, stretching from Le Boisselle to Serre...
Don't tell them.
..and in the attack on Gomicourt, the story was one of almost uniformly pitiful disaster. In the few places where the infantry actually managed to reach the German lines, they were soon isolated from their own front line and picked off piecemeal by the German counterattacks.
And the human cost is unimaginable. 57,470 casualties. That's one. There's a lot of figures here that are argued about. People add and subtract. 19,240 dead, which is to me unbelievable. The PALS battalion. I mean, we ought to make it. It wasn't just Kitchener's army going over the top, but a lot of the troops were Kitchener's army. The PALS battalions took a particular hammering. They made a virtue of recruiting friendship groups, work groups, that kind of thing. And of course, the disadvantage is that when they get the hammer, and they do, then whole villages, whole towns are plunged into mourning. And the British Army learns from this, which is why that when we did the project on the 16th Durham Light Infantry, the podcast, you notice that although a third of them or so come from Durham, the rest come from all around the country. So
so what had been gained? Narrow strip of ground about 3.5 miles wide and just a mile deep. So while this is all going on, what are the RFC doing?
Well, they're doing a lot. From about 4 o'clock in the morning, they were up. The artillery observation aircraft were up. Early morning mists, they don't get a lot done until the sun sort of burns it off. They're up there as the bombardment swells up. They're able to search out targets for their guns using their wireless communications. They identify the positions of the German batteries. There's also a problem. They haven't got the systems worked out to the peak where they can, they've got thousands of shells falling. which battery's firing which shells. They can't quite tell yet. And that, so it's all quite difficult. There's something else happening. The 22nd and 24th squadrons, they're the scout squadrons, Gaza.
Gaza.
You like being called Gaza. You are the most famous Gaza in military history. They're undertaking a constant series of patrols. What are the patrols for?
Well, they're to try to prevent any possible interference with the vital work of the core machines. We've had this conversation numerous times.
The scouts, the fighters, are actually secondary. They are there to protect the people doing the real work.
Now, you're going to tell us what Lieutenant Sidney Cohen of 24 Squadron says.
I think he's in a DH2, because I think that's...
this a de Havilland.
A de Havilland too, yeah. You're so knowledgeable these days. Anyway, this is what Sidney, as I like to think of him, says. "When over Curlew with the rest of the patrol, I saw a hostile machine over Peron and attacked, firing half a drum at about 150 yards. He turned and dived eastwards. When over Pies, about 10 minutes later, I saw two hostile aircraft, Type A, coming west over Bapaume. The other de Havillands were over Gomicourt. I dived at the hindmost machine and fired half a drum, passed him and fired the rest of the drum into the other machine. The observer in this machine ceased fire and collapsed into the nacelle. So I climbed up and, having changed drums, again attacked the first HA, hostile aircraft, which had, HA in future, which had attacked me from behind. I fired several bursts into him at close range and he suddenly did a sideslip, tail slide, and fell into a cloud, apparently out of control, and was seen to crash. About 5 minutes later, while regaining my height, somewhat over Achy-le-Grand, I saw another HA, Type C, Gary, Type C, approaching from the northeast. He opened fire at about 400 yards and turned back. I managed to get within about 200 yards, and as I was unable to catch him up, fired about 20 rounds. He dived east, and I rejoined the patrol." So that's a lot of activity, and he's basically swatting away German observation aircraft.
Under Brigadier General E.B. Ashmore's arrangements...
What's E.B. stand for?
22 Squadron were responsible for the area between Douchy and Miremont. The FE-2Bs took off in pairs and patrolled over their assigned sector of the line until they were relieved by the next pair. Now, this Lieutenants First, Brooke and Burgess took off at 06:30, but were taken by surprise as machine gun bullets ripped through their aircraft. And this is Lieutenant J.H. First, Brooke, J.H.?
We haven't looked at John Harry.
Yeah.
No, I'm not. No, sorry, listeners.
22 Squadron Royal Flyger. We normally look them up, don't we?
And we forgot.
"I left the aerodrome of my squadron at Bertangles on an FE-2B carrying two 20-pound Hales bombs. When I reached the height of 8,000 feet, I crossed the German lines in the sector between Albert and the Somme. I remember releasing one of the bombs, but do not remember the target. From that moment on, I remember nothing until I regained consciousness in a German field hospital on July the 7th. I was wounded by a machine gun bullet entering my back between the spine and shoulder blade, and it travelled in a downward direction and lodged in the diaphragm. I was unconscious for 6 days from concussion caused by my machine crashing." Wow.
That sounds dreadful.
Yes.
Now, Lieutenant Burgess, he was the pilot of their aircraft that was totally imprinted. He managed to make a reasonable crash landing. Would you like to be in a reasonable crash landing? But he dies. He succumbs to his wounds. And that's a pretty awful incident. There's another similar story, but at least Lieutenant Tudor Hart, William Tudor Hart of 22 Squadron, same squadron, he at least sees the German that shot him down. The other two didn't see him at all. And this is what he says. "I was with Captain Webb and we went about 4 or 5 miles over the German lines in his machine on 1st of July at 11 a.m. We saw 8 German machines approaching from the southwest. They were higher than us and we flew towards them to attack. 2 passed over our heads together about 300 yards or so apart and I opened fire on one. They both replied together. I gave the signal to Webb to turn so that I could fire at the other machine behind us, but he put the machine's head down. I turned to see what was the matter and he pointed to his abdomen and collapsed over the joystick. He died in a few seconds, I think, but his last thought was to save his machine. The machine at once began turning towards the German side, and I had to get back to my machine gun to fire at a machine diving at us. This happened again and again, but my fire would always prevent them finishing the dive. Other machines fired from above all the time. I had only time to get the machine pointed towards our lines when I had to get back to the gun. I never got a chance to pull Webb out of the pilot's seat, so I had to steer with my hand over the windscreen. So he's leaning back. Remember, he's in front of the pilot. He's leaning back. Unbelievable. I didn't expect to get off alive, but tried to put up as good a fight as possible and tried all the time to keep her towards our lines, but having to man the gun so often made it impossible to make progress. But the erratic course the machine flew probably saved it. At last, still being fired at, I got right down near the ground and proceeded to make a landing, as it was all I could do. I saw a lot of men with rifles and realised that I might get shot before I could set fire to the machine, so I, at the last moment, put a nose down in order to crash. One wingtip hit first. The whole machine was destroyed. I was hurled out and escaped with a bruised and paralysed side and broken ankle and rib. That might be one for our new book. What's our new book called?
Laugh or Fly.
No, beggar me, I'm a prisoner.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's going to be a prisoner.
Now, the sacrifice of men like these was justified by the fact that German aircraft were generally fended off and were unable to intervene over the battlefield itself where it actually mattered. Now, at this point, we'll take a short break to contemplate our navels.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thanks for reminding me what our new book is called, Pete, Beggar Me, I'm a Prisoner, which will be available in several years.
What was the original title?
Oh, I can't remember. Now, although many of the aircraft involved belonged to units to the north of the Somme front, the distances of 20 to 30 miles were negligible.
In an aeroplane, they are.
So redeploying units didn't pose the transportation problems that the army faced. Thus, bombing raids were launched by units of 1st, 2nd and 3rd Brigades in an attempt to cut the rail lines that would allow the Germans to move in their reserves.
What do we call that?
Interdiction. I've swallowed an interdictionary.
That's your best joke of the podcast. Actually, it's the best joke you've ever told.
Now, Lieutenant Lawrence Wingfield was one of the pilots of 3rd Brigade assisting as part of the aerial concentration on the 4th Brigade front.
Now, he's ordered to bomb the St. Quentin railway station, but there's a catch. To increase the bombing load that could be carried, these bombers are going to fly without an observer. So it's just the pilot. So it's a BE-2C. Now, we've called this a defenceless aeroplane, even with
an observer.
Because the observer is actually in front of the pilot, surrounded by bits of string and important things. Now, it is absolutely defenceless. So what does Lieutenant Lawrence Wingfield say about this, Gary?
I had to go to St. Quentin, a large town then about 35 miles on the German side of the lines, there to lay a couple of eggs on the railway station. The eggs to be carried were large ones weighing 110 pounds each and full of TNT, and I had to carry two. That, in a BE-2C, meant that all superfluous weight had to be sacrificed. No observer could be carried, and even the weight of a machine gun would be an unjustifiable load. I ultimately decided to take a machine gun, a Lewis, though it proved to be rather a disadvantage than otherwise. It was fixed in such a position that I could not readily use it, whilst its weight reduced my rate of climb. I had been informed that I was to be escorted all the way and back by a squadron of DH-2s, but in fact the escort failed to materialise. At the appointed time, I started off, arrived at the line and awaited the escort. As it did not appear in sight, I gave up waiting and proceeded over the line. The wind was southwesterly, about 30 miles per hour. I arrived at St. Quentin and dropped my bombs at the railway station. I observed a column of smoke arise to a great height. On the way home, I met a Fokker monoplane, and that was the end of the story. It took the Fokker about 15 minutes to shoot me down.
Hang on, is that the aeroplane or the pilot?
Yes, but I do not think there was at any time during the encounter much hope of my getting away from him. On my arrival on Terra Firma, which I achieved without personal injury, I found myself on a parade ground. My machine and I were immediately surrounded by German troops, and I found myself amongst gentlemen who knew Brighton and London well, and were all questioning me as to the condition of these places. Did I know them? Had they suffered very much through the war? And so on. I was able to reassure them on these points.
Now, I think that's another one for our next book, The Prisoner of War, because he's another prisoner of war. His aircraft fails to return, and several others are out there doing these bombing raids. But one of them really has an impact, because this is rare. This is a rare event. They drop bombs on their railway station, but we have an anonymous German soldier. He becomes a prisoner of war of the British. And during the interrogation, he reveals the following things, and this is going to be you. I dread to think which accent you're going to use. It's either Blücher or Richthofen, but whether I can tell the difference is...
At the end of the month of June, Richthofen, the 22nd Reserve Division was at rest in the neighbourhood of St. Quentin. On the 1st of July... The division was warned to proceed to the Somme front. About 3:30 p.m., the 1st Battalion of the 71st Reserve Regiment and the 11th Reserve Jaeger Battalion were at St. Quentin Station, ready to entrain. Arms were piled, and the regimental transport was being loaded onto the train. At this moment, English aeroplanes appeared overhead and dropped bombs. One bomb fell on a shed, which was filled with ammunition and caused a big explosion. There were 200 wagons of ammunition in the station at the time. 60 of them caught fire and exploded. The remainder were saved with difficulty. The train allotted to the transport of troops and all the equipment which they had placed on the platform were destroyed by fire. The men were panic-stricken and fled in every direction. 180 men were either killed or wounded. It was not till several hours later that it was possible to collect the men of the 71st Regiment. It was then sent back to billets.
So, I mean, by that account, that was a very successful raid on that station, St. Quentin. But there's lots of... They make a lot of raids. They're aiming at the major junctions, aren't they? Rail junctions, the railheads, places like Cambrai, Bussigny, St. Quentin, what we just mentioned. And they also attack the German headquarters at Bapaume. What is the problem with bombing? We've got to repeat this. That account you just gave us, it could be successful. But what's normally the problem?
Well, it's difficult to achieve direct hits with the primitive bomb aimers that are available, and the load that the bombing force carried. It was nowhere near enough to flatten a target without a certain amount of luck. Hence, results were often patchy, but they did achieve some successes, and this is Lieutenant Scott of 5 Squadron Royal Flying Corps.
I saw a train about 4 miles from Cambrai on the Cambrai-Douai line, going towards Douai. I opened from 7,000 feet at it. When it saw me coming, it pulled up and started going backwards to Cambrai. When I was at about 1,000 feet, I released my bombs. The train pulled up. Suddenly, one of my bombs fell 30 yards in front of the rear coach, destroying the line and preventing the train going back to Cambrai. Another bomb fell on the... That was nearly a berm. Bomb fell on the embankment. When about 300 feet from the train, I came under heavy machine gun fire. Flying wires, Longueron, petrol tank was shot and several holes in the machine. But he's done reasonably well. He's embuggered them. That train, you know, it can't go back.
He has done well. And another notable success was achieved by Lieutenant A.L. Gordon Kidd of 7 Squadron, who, from the height of just 900 feet, Pete, so that's just above your head, scored a direct hit on a train as it passed through a cutting. The train had obviously been carrying ammunition, for his bomb set off a series of explosions and a major fire that was still burning several hours later.
So there were successes, but this is not interdiction as in cutting off. This is embuggerance it's worth trying anyway. Now, let's get on. The 32 Squadron. Now, that's the DH2 Scout Squadron of 3rd Brigade. So they're a bit to the north of the Somme. They took a 0340. And they're escorting the aircraft of 2nd and 25th Squadron on their bombing raids on the railway, on the rail communications. Now, who's their squadron leader? Who is that masked man?
Well, that's Major Lionel Rees, and he ignored the standing orders to stay on the ground, and he himself took off at 0535, accompanied by Lieutenant J.C. Simpson to patrol over the Luce area north of the Somme. Now, Simpson and Rees were soon separated, and at 0615, when Rees saw a formation of aircraft above him, he assumed it was one of the British formations returning from their mission. Now, he began to climb, intending to help escort them home, when he identified that they were German.
What does he do?
Well, he's utterly undaunted, and he continues to climb. And you're going to relate what Major Lionel Rees of 32 Squadron says.
As I got nearer at about Anaquin, the second machine turned out of the position and dived towards me, firing his guns. I waited until he came within a convenient range and fired one drum. After about the 30th round, I saw the top of his fuselage splinter between the pilot and the observer. The machine turned round and went home. Don't blame it. This machine was marked with a big 3 and a small cross on the fuselage. I then went to attack a second machine. When he saw me, he fired red Very lights, and 3 more joined him. They fired an immense amount of ammunition, but were so far away that they had no effect. The escort machines swooped down onto their own machine instead of me, and so shot past him and went out of action. When I got to a convenient position, I fired one drum. After about 30 rounds, a big cloud of blue haze came out of the nacelle in front of the pilot. The machine turned and wobbled, and I last saw him down over the lines, under control. It looked either as if a cylinder was knocked off or else the petrol tank was punctured. I then saw 5 more aircraft close together. They opened fire at very long range. I closed and fired one drum at very long range at the centre, and the 5 dispersed in all directions. I then saw the leader and the two second machines going west. I overhauled them rapidly, and when I got near the lowest, he turned sharply to the left and dropped a bomb. He opened fire at long range. I closed. Just as I was about to fire, a shot struck me in the leg, putting the leg temporarily out of action. I fired another drum, but not having complete control of the rudder, I swept the machine backwards and forwards. I finished firing about 10 yards away and saw the observer sitting back firing straight up into the air instead of at me. I grabbed my pistol, but dropped it on the floor of the nacelle and could not get it again. I then recovered the use of my leg and saw the leader going towards the lines. I got within long range of him. He was firing an immense amount of ammunition. Just before he reached the lines, I gave him one more drum. Having finished my ammunition, I came home. Now, you're probably imagining, Gary, in your simple laddish chap, that he'd got a little nick on his leg, are you? You know, just a bit of a knock, perhaps a flesh wound. Well, it wasn't. He was extraordinarily badly wounded. And one of the reasons we know that, besides the report, is that Second Lieutenant Gwilym Lewis saw him land. And you're going to tell us what 32 Squadron, 2nd Lieutenant Gwilym Lewis, he was one of the last two RFC pilots to die. Relatively recently, him and Cecil Lewis. That's the secret of long life.
So I'm going to change my name by deed poll.
To Lewis, yeah.
No, to Gwilym.
No, it's not Gwilym.
Yeah. This is what 2nd Lieutenant Gwilym Lewis says. I told you he was the bravest man in the world. He came across them a little later, and the Archie's batteries say they have never seen anything so gallant or comic in their lives. The Huns were in a tight little bunch when he came along. After he had finished, they were all scattered in 2s and 1s all over the sky, not knowing which way to go. He landed in the usual manner, taxied in. They got the steps for him to get out of his machine. He got out and sat in the grass and calmly told the fellows to bring him a tender to take him to hospital. I'm afraid he has got a very bad wound, though he is lucky not to have had an artery in his leg shot, as I understand he would never have got back if he had. Of course, everyone knows the Major is mad. I don't think he was ever more happy in his life than attacking those Huns. He said he would have brought them all down one after the other if he could have just used his leg.
And amazing. And I would imagine that, his cockpit was half full of blood by the end of it, because it was a bad wound. So let's move on and move on. So another chap, Captain Wiley of 23 Squadron RFC, he's assigned to a series of reconnaissance and offensive patrols. He's in an FE-2B. What would you say FE-2Bs are, other than are probably one of our favourite aircraft? What do they attract?
Well, I think you mean they're like a sort of a magnet to trouble, aren't they? And once more, Captain Harold Wiley is in the thick of the action again, and this is what he says of 23 Squadron. He is.
He is, yeah. Went on reconnaissance at 3:15 p.m. to find out whether reinforcements were being sent up the road. Ordered to stay over 2 hours. Unfortunately, we had to carry 4 bombs, which spoilt our climbing. Went over lines at 7,500 feet. Dropped bombs as soon as possible and got to 8,000 feet. Shelled heavily going over. Met 5 Huns at Volks. Can't spell it. Engage. They got tired of it after about 15 minutes close action and went down, giving us some parting shots as they went. Solly got in a very good burst. That's his observer. Very good burst at one fellow. And he got on his gliding angle at once and didn't appear anymore. So he's been badly hit. He's just gliding off, this German. My flight behaved well and got off their drums. The issue of the flight was never in doubt. Solly was hit in the thigh very early in the fight, but did not tell me, these guys. Another bullet ripped up one of his boots. The way he worked his gun was splendid. He got off 260 rounds. He had a marvellous escape as one bullet went right through the upper tube of the nacelle, not a foot from him, and made a big hole in the top plane. His very light pistol was smashed by another and his map case cut. We could have followed the enemy down, but it would have been too risky to lose much height, as it was blowing hard from the west and we were on reconnaissance. We saw 3 of them land on their aerodrome at Quillant. As we were recrossing the line, we saw that Gopsil was in great danger from an albatross who was coming up behind him. We immediately dived 1,000 feet at him and got off a burst. 2 others did the same, and after another dive and burst, the Hun made off for Plouvain. We were being very badly shelled. He means Archie here, anti-aircraft at the time, but managed to get back into some sort of formation and all got over the line safely but low down. Solly, I'm sorry to say, left the squadron this evening. A very great loss. Gopsil had his radiator shot through by the albatross, but landed in the aerodrome. Poor boy, this is the second time in a few days he's been shot down. Now, that's another amazing story. And that, I mean, Solly must have been lucky, because it sounds to me like a burst of bullets just went, one of them through him, but the rest just went through everything round him. Amazing escape.
Second Lieutenant Morris and Sergeant Glover of 11 Squadron, they also ran into a group of German aircraft. And this is what Second Lieutenant Lionel Morris of 11 Squadron says about that encounter.
And he's the chap who's shot down by Richthofen in September.
Had been patrolling for about half an hour and had turned north from Gommecourt towards Souchez when we saw some specks over the Hun line coming towards Souchez. I turned the nose of the machine towards Souchez. He's saying Souchez a lot.
He is.
And we gradually saw that 11 machines were coming towards us, all very high. After about 5 minutes, we discovered that they were 11 Huns. We were at 9,000 feet, and the lowest Hun was about 9,300 feet. So we tackled him. One of the others came up and fired at us, but after a few shots from us, he sheered off and left us to deal with the first one. The Hun opened fire at about 300 yards, but Glover reserved his fire until we were within about 30 yards of him and then gave him a burst of about 10 shots. He then circled and we followed and got in 2 more bursts of tracer, both of which I saw were well into him. He then put his nose down and I saw some pieces of stuff flying off him. He went right down and disappeared through a bank of clouds. We then had time to look around, and I discovered that our engine was going badly, and we couldn't climb at all, and as the rest of the Huns were almost out of sight, we decided to come home. When we got home, we discovered that our machine had been hit in several places. There was a hole through the front of the nacelle and several through the planes, while the engine had gone dud owing to a cylinder having been hit. Archie reported that the Hun we hit went right down and probably crashed. We were awfully bucked, of course.
Yeah, these reports, when they refer to that, what they mean is that the anti-aircraft gun observers watched and would report back as to what they saw. That's what's happening. There must have been a lot of tension on as you can imagine, pilots flying off on these missions and they're life or death, aren't they? That's what's coming through to me in this.
And this is Captain Maurice Baring of the Headquarters Royal Flying Corps. And this is what he's talking about, what's happening on the ground.
After luncheon with Waldron and Smith Barry, I saw the pilots start, and then one waited and waited. Who would come back? Who would not come back? At 4:30, Ferdy Waldron came back with his machine riddled with bullets. I went home at 4:30 and reported to the general, that's Trenchard, and then went back again at 6 and stayed till 6:30. This time I saw a lot of pilots hot from the fighting and in a high state of exhilaration as they had had a grand day. Now, so who's winning? Now, so the Germans have won on the ground. Are we arguing about that? No.
No, that's quite clear. But it's apparent that they hadn't actually won in the air. They've been roundly defeated, I think, in the air. Over the battlefield, it was...
We're not having statistics.
Oh, we have to have a statistic. Over the battlefield, it was estimated that some 110 pilots were in the air for some 108 hours, and there were only 9 combats.
I'm dubious about that stat, which I know is from my book.
The British had harvested the fruits of the Royal Flying Corps aerial supremacy, but they couldn't counterbalance the miscalculations and tactical naivety that was fully exposed on the ground.
Yeah, basically they could fly freely over ground that the unsilenced German gun batteries and machine guns made it impossible to cross on to get across by foot. So this is where the title of that book, which I wrote in back in the 1990s, some success, because in the air the Royal Flying Corps are doing brilliantly. They're not developed fully into the role that they'd have in 17 and 18, but they are on the way. This is their coming of age battle, isn't it? So what do you think the Germans thought of the Royal Flying Corps?
They admired them immensely.
You think so?
Well, we're going to find out in the next few episodes, Pete.
We are. Can't wait. Can't wait, Gary. I am all on tenterhooks. My foibles are foibling.
Yeah, it was a shame you confused battery and buggery at the start of this, though.
No, I... We're off.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit
blah.
www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?